Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Our guest on today's show, Max Blumenthal, says most Americans have opinions about Israel without actually knowing much about it, in particular the deepening crisis it faces as a society and as a democracy. So Max Blumenthal spent 4 years researching and reporting for extended periods in Israel, speaking with politicians, public intellectuals, peace activists, and getting out on the street of Israel's cities and towns to get a feel for the way Israelis see themselves and their place in the world. The result is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And it's a vivid picture of the socio-political landscape of a country that ignites intense debate here in the United States and around the world. Max Blumenthal says he tries to bring his readers the facts of today's Israel, unadorned and unsanitized, without sentimentality and nostalgia. And having read Goliath, I can tell you it definitely does that. It is a remarkable series of snapshots of some of the most disturbing trends in Israeli politics and society. The mainstreaming of far-right politicians like Avigdor Lieberman, the intensifying marginalization of Israel's Palestinian minority, and the racism directed at African asylum seekers. It is a tough and enlightening book. It's also one that's drawn some real sharp criticism. And I'm very glad we have this hour to talk about it and to take your calls and emails for Max Blumenthal. Max, thanks so much for being on Your Call.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Max, let's first start. Great. Max, good to have you with us. We had a bit of a glitch there, so I didn't hear you say hi, but welcome to the show.
Can you hear me okay?
You are loud and clear. Thank you so much.
Great.
And I want to let folks know that Max is going to be in San Jose tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the San Jose Peace and Justice Center if you want to go and meet him and listen to him and talk with him in person. And all the details about that are on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Max, I just want to start with where you start in the book, which is by saying that that you brought to this work the same journalistic method you did to your last book, which was a New York Times bestseller, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, which really looked at the takeover of the GOP by its most right-wing elements. Now, it should be said, people who don't know, your father, Sidney Blumenthal, prominent advisor to President Clinton, well-known Democrat, and I think it's fair from reading your work to say your politics are probably to the left of most Democrats. So I think most people would think, hey, if you're going to something about the right wing of the Republican Party, you're going to be coming in with a basically critical position about who they are and what they're out to do. Was that also the case when you went to Israel to start working on this book in 2009? Were you in a kind of fundamentally critical position from the get-go?
Well, just to clarify, my father's also a well-known journalist.
Yes, absolutely.
So I'm not really looking at things from a partisan perspective on this issue. I mean,
right,
you have kind of a bipartisan project to promote the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel, and so it's pretty easy to look outside that as a journalist. I've been fascinated with this subject for much of my life, and I've watched as the facts on the ground have gotten worse and worse, right-wing trends deepening in Israeli society, as you mentioned, and the occupation of Palestine deepening, the institutional discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel worsening behind the Green Line. And after Operation Cast Lead, which was the Israeli attack on the besieged Gaza Strip in late 2008 and 2009, carried out during a national election campaign in which the most right-wing government in Israel's history was elected, I basically spent my royalties from Republican Gomorrah to start a new book project, which has, you know, culminated with the release this month of Goliath. And definitely, you know, as someone who was writing for a primarily liberal, democratic, or progressive audience, the reception of this book has been markedly different than Republican Gomorrah. And, you know, I'm not able to get the same amount of fresh air on this book tour as I was before. I don't know if there is an active campaign to suppress the book per se, but there is a fear of discussing a lot of the issues I present and the facts I present in it in the United States, a fear of offending powerful people who are pro-Israel ideologues, and also just a general fear of backlash. I really appreciate you having me on this show.
Well, hey, we've got an hour here to talk about the stories that you tell in this book, to give your perspective, and also to open the lines to our listeners to give them a chance to respond and ask their questions about what you have to say. I guess what I'm asking is, not so much, obviously, this is not, at least in Washington terms, a partisan debate when it comes to talking about U.S. support for Israel or in, you know, kind of mainstream media about coverage of Israel. I guess the question more is, when you went to start the reporting on this book. Kind of where were you in your thinking about Israel, and how has that changed in over that, you know, nearly 4 years of reporting and research that you did?
You know, my perspective on the situation hasn't changed, at least the broad outlines of the situation. But, you mentioned in the beginning that listeners have their opinions. I have my opinions, too. I'm pretty clear about my opinions. But what I've tried to do in this book is, you know, offer readers the chance to come to their own conclusions. And one of the things that, I guess, surprised me as I started immersing myself in Israeli society and Palestinian society is especially in places like Jerusalem, where I spent several months living in central Jerusalem, was the degree to which daily acts of racism and racist incitement are treated as kind of normal and banal, and people basically ignore it or brush it off and dismiss it. And this includes, you know, the 20% of Jewish Israeli citizens who really oppose that kind of, who actively oppose and are repelled by that. I mean, Akiva Elder, who is a veteran Israeli journalist who's covered the conflict for 30 years or more, wrote a really positive review of my book for Al Monitor, and he said that the book, one of the things that was remarkable of the book is it reminded him of the horrors that had faded into bas relief in his life that he had forgot existed. That's something that happened to me. I just basically became almost, I risked spending about a year inside Israel-Palestine becoming immune or inured to the daily acts of violence and cruelty that I would see all around me.
Well, let me just follow up just on another parallel between thinking about Republican Gomorrah and Goliath, and then we'll move on to talk about some of the really important stories you tell in the book. I think that if in the United States we'd say, okay, let's focus on the most right-wing elements of the Republican Party and draw conclusions about what the United States is from that, it could give us a distorted view. And it's fair to say, I think, in Goliath, you talked to an incredible number of people across the range of Israeli society, but you do spend a lot of attention on really powerful right-wing figures, you know, from Avigdor Lieberman on down. I mean, do you feel like, I mean, just tell me, as a comparison, the Tea Party to American politics as a whole, someone like Avigdor Lieberman, who's now the Minister of Foreign Affairs, to Israeli politics, is that, you know, what's the, how similar or different is that when you make that kind of parallel?
Well, one of the differences is, you know, I profiled a lot of Christian right figures in Republican Gomorrah, people like James Dobson, who spent his lifetime as the head of Focus on the Family, demonizing homosexuals and, you know, attacking women who are, you know, attacking liberated women, you know, the rhetoric you're accustomed to. I talk about Pastor John Hagee, the Christian Zionist preacher who said that the Antichrist, when he returns, will be homosexual and half Jewish, as Hitler was. These people have a lot of money. But in Israel, I write extensively about a core of state-sponsored rabbis. These are official rabbis, and hundreds of them have issued rabbinical edicts, first of all, banning or warning people against renting apartments to non-Jews, and their wives issued a separate letter warning of Jewish-Arab relationships and warning that people will be condemned under Jewish law, especially women, if they date Arab men. Which was written to support a rising anti-miscegenation movement in Israel, led by a group called Lehava, which is actually run by former members of the Kahanist Kach Party, which is a terror organization that was actually outlawed in Israel. And they have set up an anti-miscegenation coast guard to warn Jewish women on the beaches against dating Arab men. They have just set up a hotline where people can inform on interreligious daters. Lehava is the brother organization of a group called Mercy, which runs a home for Jewish women who have supposedly run away from Arab relationships with Arab men. And this home is supported by the state. It's received half of its annual budget from the state of Israel. So we're looking at figures like Dov Lior, who is an extremist rabbi in occupied Hebron, who actually helped inspire the assassination of former Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, declaring him a traitor and a snitch on the Jewish people, who has called for live experimentation on Palestinian prisoners. And this is a state rabbi who's supported with money from the state of Israel, because in order to confer upon itself the image of the Jewish state, it requires these religious figures. So you're looking at more of a situation that's more akin to Saudi Arabia than the United States and Israel, and these forces are gaining enormous power, and that's because they've been endorsed by the state. And as you mentioned, Avigdor Lieberman is a major figure in this book. He is the leader of the Yisrael Biteinu party, which was in the last Knesset, the third biggest party, and he is called basically for the transfer of thousands of Palestinian citizens out of Israel to improve Israel's Jewish demographic majority. And, you know, you don't hear that kind of rhetoric from neo-fascists in Europe. Like, Geert Wilders rarely says that kind of thing. Jörg Haider, when he was alive, you didn't hear that. They've called for keeping non-white Christians out of their countries, but they didn't call for removing anyone from their homes or redrawing borders to strip them of their citizenship. And so that's what's extremely disturbing, is that Palestinian citizens of Israel are actually living in jeopardy in their own homes and feeling like their future is at risk because of the kind of people who are in power and who are increasingly popular.
Well, just by the nature of the kind of democracy that you have in Israel, where you have to build a coalition, and there are a lot of parties with some incredible range of positions. I guess my question would be, to what extent is Lieberman and his party, as part of the coalition that has supported Prime Minister Netanyahu, to what extent are their opinions or positions part of the government's position?
Well, this, you know, the government's position and every government's position in Israel has been to engineer the Jewish demographic majority of the state. This is what required, and I talk about this extensively in my book. I present all the history of 1948, but it's what basically required the expulsion of 750,000 indigenous Palestinians. That's how the Jewish state was built, and this is how the Jewish majority is maintained, through the construction of things like the separation wall, which Benjamin Netanyahu endorsed because it would prevent quote-unquote demographic spillover. Netanyahu is warned, and you know, he consults state planners on this all the time, including people I profile in the book that your listeners have never heard of, like Arnon Sofer, who is the key demographer in Israel. Netanyahu has warned that the level of non-Jewish residents or citizens that reside in a territory Israel controls cannot exceed 30%, or Israel risks becoming a binational state. So in this country, we don't have a level of non-white Christians who can reside in the United States, and I think most Americans are comfortable with the fact that by 2050, this country will be majority brown, majority non-white. So Israel's unique in that regard. It claims to be a Jewish and democratic state, defining Jewish in an ethnic sense, which is why it needs to import millions of Russians, for example, and why it has marked and tried to entice people like me to quote-unquote return, to immigrate. And that's unique in the world. It's basically an ethnocracy and not a democracy, because it privileges one ethnic group over all others, and then it predicates all its policy on engineering the demographic majority of that group to maintain its character as a Jewish state. So, you know, Israel is in a process right now, in a political crisis, and you see this in the Knesset, where I spend a lot of time, which is the Israeli parliament, of trying to decide what its identity is. Is it going to be a state of all its citizens? Is it going to be a true democracy, or will it be a Jewish state? And what the people who are popular now, like Naftali Bennett, who is an increasingly popular young politician who's very attractive to other younger Israelis, he's in his 40s, completely rejects a two-state solution, favors annexing much of the West Bank. He heads the third largest party in Israel, Jewish Home. He is the economics minister. And he has introduced legislation in the Knesset that will permanently define Israel's Jewish character as superior and more important than its democratic charter. And personally, just my own opinion is, I'm in favor of Israel defining itself one way or another, just so we can address its national identity accordingly.
This is Max Blumenthal. He's the author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, also author of the best-selling Republican Gomorrah that came out a few years ago. If you'd like to join the conversation here on Your Call, the number to ring us at is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. And Max Blumenthal spent much of the last 4 years in Israel looking at the political situation there and developments happening across the board in Israeli society, including talking to a lot of Palestinian Israelis and talking about what they're facing, which we're going to be talking about more in this hour. But if you're someone who has spent time in Israel or the occupied territories in recent years, be very interested in your thoughts about what Max Blumenthal has reported in this book, what he's talking about, and just what he's getting at here, the nature of Israeli society and the Israeli state, that tension between being a Jewish state and a democratic state, and how it is working itself out. 866-798-8255, or you can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back on the show tomorrow. So, Max, I wanted to ask, because you, in the book, I think one of the things I found really enlightening, just I had not heard covered, was really this question of Palestinians within Israel. I think a lot of people have heard about settlements in the West Bank and, you know, the attempt to kind of make facts on the ground in the occupied territories, but much less about this kind of demographic strategy and what it's meant within Israel and the pressure that it's put on Palestinian communities there.
Yeah, a lot of Americans don't know that there are 1.5 million Palestinian citizens of Israel, and that while the state of Israel boasts that they enjoy full equality, the reality is a whole lot different. And the reality has worsened since the election that my book begins on, which is the 2009 elections, when Avigdor Lieberman and other parties ran on a platform of no loyalty, no citizenship. They basically demonized a lot of Palestinian citizens of Israel who identify as Palestinians as disloyal to the Jewish state. And they demanded that they take loyalty oaths and go through a whole process, a humiliating process, legal process, in order to prove their loyalty or face the wholesale stripping of their citizenship rights. And we've seen this with legislation introduced by Netanyahu, who's amended Israel's citizenship law to demand that all new citizens swear loyalty to the Jewish and democratic state, which basically will prevent Palestinian residents of Jerusalem from taking up new citizenship. I spent a lot of time writing about a place I lived in for a few months, Jaffa, which is part of the Tel Aviv municipality, but it's a primarily Palestinian citizen city. It's comprised of the remnants of the expulsions in 1948. It's very impoverished, and people there are facing a wave of gentrification that is different than the kind of gentrification you see in San Francisco or Brooklyn, in that it's strategic and planned in order to basically drive them out. Palestinian citizens of Israel have an impossible time trying to get permits to rebuild or renovate their homes, and so when they do so and can't get a permit, they get an eviction order. There are now 500 standing eviction orders in Jaffa. And I went 15 minutes east to the city of Lod, which is right in the Green Line, right inside Israel, major Israeli city. It's a mixed city, meaning it has Jewish and Palestinian residents. And I went to a neighborhood of families, all from one family, the Abu Aid family, and their homes had been all bulldozed the night before. It looked like something I'd seen in the West Bank, except these were technically Israeli citizens, and what they had done was expand their homes for their growing families without permits, because they couldn't get their permits, and much of their neighborhood had strangely been zoned as agricultural land. So they were all sleeping in tents in the middle of a major Israeli city, including teenagers who were trying to go to school. It was the rainy season, so they were the kids were unable to do their schoolwork, and this is, you know, incredibly tragic to see inside the Green Line. I went south to the Negev Desert, again in the Green Line, to meet some Israeli citizens who just happened to be non-Jewish in the village of Al-Araqib. I spent the night in the village because they expected a demolition. All of their homes had been declared illegal because they had built them without permits they couldn't receive, and the state of Israel was planning to build a forest on top of their land, which was co-sponsored by an evangelical network, a Christian Zionist network in the UK called God TV. It would be called God TV Forest. So strangely, they were building a forest in the desert, and that necessitated the demolition of this village. I witnessed bulldozers come in and riot squads toss people out of their homes, and the bulldozers just level the village to the ground. Actually, you can watch my video of it. It's called Israel's Third Destruction of Al-Araqib, A-R-A-K-I-B, on YouTube. And, you know, what's happened to this village is its residents, who are Bedouin citizens of Israel, many of them have actually served in the Israeli army, is that they keep rebuilding their homes. And so they've been bulldozed since then 51 times. That's the most times I've ever heard of a village being demolished. And there's a clear plan now. It's called the Praver Plan, P-R-A-W-E-R, to remove 40,000 Bedouins from their ancestral lands in the Negev Desert and force them into these Indian reservation-style communities that the state is building. And the real reason that they're doing it is to build Jews, small Jews-only communities that will replace them in order to limit their natural growth and to preserve the demographic majority of Jewish Israelis. This is clearly an undemocratic policy. It's, you know, what I document in my book, along with, you know, the stories of the real people who are grappling with the consequences of these kinds of policies. And we see it on both sides of the Green Line, including the area of Israel that will be legitimized under a two-state solution.
That's the voice of Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call, and the number, if you'd like to join us, is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. And on the line with us from San Leandro is Antonio. Antonio, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning. This is my question, because every time I listen to a program on the radio or wherever, speaking for both sides of the issue, there's always a Jew on one side and on the other. There's nobody else who can speak. They are particularly people who are not Jews are banned from discussing this issue. And I think what is lacking is that nobody on the supposedly on the side of the Palestinians, being a Jew, will question the basic of it. The basic of it is the ideology of the Jewish state. It's based on the chosen people and the promised land. And that's Judaism. That's the ideology behind it.
Well, Antonio, we're going to be going to a break here in a moment, so I want to make sure that Max has a chance to respond. Max, what about that idea of who has the legitimacy to criticize Israel and that question of really the core ideology? I think you actually get at it quite a bit in Goliath.
Yeah, I do get at the core ideology. I don't totally agree with the listener's characterization, but I do agree that it is a problem to see all Jewish panels at a lot of forums on Israel-Palestine where Palestinians themselves aren't represented, because there are a lot of really remarkable Palestinian journalists and intellectuals in the U.S. who have a lot to say about it, and I think it's imperative that their voices be heard. I often play into this problematic dynamic through the phenomenon of Jewish substitution, where even groups that favor Palestinian rights will prefer to put a Jew out in public instead of a Palestinian because their voices are given more weight and credibility in this society. And so there is a problem there.
Max Blumenthal, if you can just hold that thought right there. We've got to go to a break. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on Your Call. We're talking to Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And we'll be taking more of your calls and questions, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We welcome your questions, comments, experiences. We'll be back right after this.
Local Public Radio, always better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. We do podcast our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we're going to be looking at the foreclosure crisis in Richmond and the innovative way that they're trying to take it on using eminent domain. We want to just ask, can a single city take on the big banks when it comes to foreclosures? That's tomorrow on Your Call. And if you have a show idea for us, we always welcome them. Drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or call us at 866-798-8255, where you can join us now in our conversation with Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. This brand new book really delves into the transformations that have been happening in Israel, both in its politics and society. And I wanted to ask you, Max, just kind of following up on something kind of related to what Antonio brought up. I mean, we do have, obviously, a Jewish community here in the United States, which is largely quite supportive of Israel. And at minimum, even if they might take some of these criticisms that you bring to the table, you know, they'd certainly take them seriously. At the same time, might also have, you know, still have some fundamental sympathy with the idea of a Jewish state. And that ideology, that core ideology of Zionism that Antonio was talking about, and which you talk about in Goliath, if you might kind of, I understand, take it a slightly different way. But I guess when I read this book, and also when I watch the online videos that you've produced, one of the things that strikes me is that outside of a few brave dissenters, I really feel like Israelis come across as either really angry, often racist, or, you know, and often delusional by you. I mean, that's kind of the way that I feel like they get framed often in the stories that you tell. And I just wonder, number one, whether you think you're going to be able to speak to a broader audience that may have some fundamental sympathy with Israel and its purpose. And second, whether you feel like you give Israelis a fair shake in that sense, whether we get a full sense of who the Israeli people are now.
Well, I don't know if I'll be given enough space to talk about this book to really in you know, Jewish communal forums or any at all. But, you know, if you come to my talks at any bookstores, I was just at Politics and Prose, which is, you know, the major political bookstore in Washington, D.C. There were young people who were involved with groups like J Street who are pretty open to hearing what I'm presenting and interested in it, and, you know, who have contact with a lot of Israeli dissidents. And, you know, I don't know what the ultimate impact of the book is, but as a journalist, it's really my job to present the facts as I saw them. And obviously, I'm not shy about my perspective. But as far as, you know, this idea of good and bad, I totally reject that when it comes to Israel-Palestine. That, of course, there are good Israelis and there are bad Israelis. There are good Palestinians and bad Israelis. There's plenty of Palestinians I don't like. But the issue is that everyone is between the river and the sea is currently living under some form of Israeli control. It's generally a system of institutional discrimination. It's a unique system in the world because it's an ethnocracy that privileges one group over others. And so I really, what my book presents is a bunch of people who've been thrown together in a situation that's basically unmanageable and that's corrosive to the social fabric of Jewish, Israeli, and Palestinian society. And, you know, it's really a portrait of a society, I think, at a terminal phase, that, you know, during a transition that began after the collapse of a really deceptive peace process. And so you wonder why. I mean, I profile a lot of Jewish Israelis who are resisting this system and who are facing harsh consequences, like Yonatan Shapira, who is a former Israeli combat pilot from a family that's always done military service, an elite family in Tel Aviv, who during the Second Intifada decided to refuse to participate in bombing raids of the Gaza Strip and organized a pilot's letter of refusal, starting him on this path of open conflict with the state and its security mechanisms, which are there to surveil people like him. So that by the time I got there and we became friendly, Yonatan was being interrogated by the Shin Bet, Israel's General Security Service, because he had actually gone out and gone on a tour of Europe and called for a boycott of Israeli institutions that are involved in the occupation. He realized there was no way for him to work inside the political mechanisms of Israeli society and actually achieve change. So he went outside and did what the famous Israeli philosopher Yeshayahu Leibovich encouraged young Jewish Israelis to do, which is to organize mass insubordination against the occupation. There are maybe less than 700 people like Yonatan in Israeli society. If you look at youth attitudes, you read the polls by pollsters like Camille Fuchs, who's the most reputable pollster in Israel right now. You see in poll after poll a majority of Israeli Jewish youth declaring their refusal to sit in the same classroom as an Arab. You see a majority of Jewish Israelis declaring their refusal to live next door to an Arab or to live next door to a non-Jewish guest worker. And this is being encouraged through the educational system. That's the problem. Israel has full conscription for all its male and female citizens. They have to go to the army at age 18. So school is really a process of preparation for military service and for participation in the domination and control of Palestinians who've been under occupation for almost 50 years. That's how it's corrosive. I write about a preschool in Holon, just outside Tel Aviv, where four-year-old children, Jewish Israeli children, are lined up before a blackboard which has a poster on it. And the poster starts with a question: who wants to kill us? Then lines point to Arabs, Nazis, Persians. Then the lines point to another question: what do we need? And then the line points to an answer: we need a state. And this process continues throughout high school until age 17, when many Jewish Israelis, 25%, are sent on trips to Auschwitz, where they participate in the March of Living alongside uniformed Israeli soldiers. And the trips are explicitly designed to produce more nationalistic sentiments in these kids, and a more positive view of the army, when many of them have skepticism and questions about what they might do in the West Bank.
But Max, I think the stories you tell in those terms are really powerful. I think most people don't know the detail of that kind of. I mean, it's fair to say indoctrination that's going on. But when you look in the context that Israel is in, isn't there a lot of indoctrination going on, not just within Israel's borders, but nearby as well? I mean, we could look at Palestinian textbooks or textbooks of other places nearby and say, oh, okay, they're not exactly getting an understand the other message.
No, although actually Palestinian Authority textbooks were reviewed recently, and they didn't find the kind of anti-Semitism that the State of Israel finds in them. But of course, there is rampant anti-Semitism and incitement in Palestinian society as well. But you're looking at a society that's been facing dispossession for over 100 years. You're looking at a situation of settler colonialism, where one group has come from the outside and declared its intention to remove another group. This naturally produces violence. It produced violence in the United States among Native Americans resisting American settler colonialism, and it produced violence in South Africa. Nelson Mandela organized an armed struggle against the apartheid government of South Africa. Violence is really at a low ebb right now in Israel-Palestine, and it's the product of a lot of factors. But violence was inevitable when the kind of system that provided superior rights to one group over the indigenous group was inaugurated. And so naturally the violence comes with and processes of indoctrination on both sides to prepare young people for resistance. And the difference is that Israeli society presents itself as this vibrant democracy, and it's always presented the army as a democratizing mechanism. But what I found was that it was quite the opposite, especially interviewing women from the group New Profile, who are basically middle-aged, middle-class Jewish Israeli women who live in Tel Aviv and West Jerusalem. And their goal is to help counsel the young people who don't want to do military service, either because they don't want to for political reasons, they don't want to dominate and control Palestinians, or it just doesn't feel right. And you see more and more young Israelis refusing to do it. And so for counseling them, because these are mainly feminists, and they see this as particularly corrosive to young women because sexual abuse and rape is rampant in the Israeli army. The Knesset subcommittee showed that one out of three women had faced sexual abuse in the army. So they're trying to help counsel young people out. And these women from Tel Aviv have all been called in for interrogations. They've had their computers seized. They're under surveillance. And so the the window of democracy is really closing. The Democratic space is shrinking.
I want to break in just because we have full lines, and I want to make sure to get to the folks who are on the line and want to talk with you. Margaret in San Francisco. Margaret, welcome to your call.
Thank you. Congratulations, Matt, for trying to bring some sort of clarity to what he is doing. I'm saying doing. There's a lot of distortion in what he said.
No, Margaret, Margaret, talk directly to Max. He's right here with you. He's listening.
Max, or whoever you are, Mr. Blumenthal, that wall which you describe as being built to keep out Arabs from living in territories that the Israelis occupy, you know very well that that is up. That wall has been built to prevent terrorism.
All right, Margaret, that's
1 minute, yeah. Matt. And as a matter of fact, it's been quite successful. The terrorist acts have dropped dramatically with the wall, although there are periodic attempts by Palestinian youths to bring it down or drill holes in it. Thank you, Matt.
Max, go ahead and respond to Margaret.
Yeah, Margaret has never been in Area A, the area that's really confined by the wall in the occupied West Bank. If she had, I was, just in Ramallah in September, and my friends, who are actually, many of them are American citizens, but they're Palestinian, so they have Palestinian IDs, they asked me to sneak them into Israel, sneak them through this wall, which is a demographic wall, which has been built to limit their freedom of movement. This wall, which is expropriated over 100,000 acres of Palestinian farmland, and they're still able to get through. I know Palestinians who jump the wall. I could have signed up to jump the wall myself. It's very easy to get through the wall. You just have to risk jail or even getting shot. But they do it, and so it would be possible to organize a campaign of suicide bombing. It's just that the factions in the West Bank have called off this tactic and decided that it was unproductive, that it was a failed tactic. The wall hasn't stopped any terror. Instead, it's inspired more and more hatred and resentment. And it's a unique thing that I've never seen anywhere else in my life. And you see other walls that are designed, and you see walls even in mixed Israeli cities between Jewish neighborhoods and Palestinian neighborhoods. So the wall is not necessarily about terrorism. And I write extensively and meticulously in Goliath about the state planners who helped convince Israeli leaderships of the necessity of the wall, like Arnon Sofer, who said the wall was necessary because of the fear that Israel could become, could lose its Jewish demographic majority by 2020. And, I would just ask Margaret to consider, what if Jews were confined behind that wall? What if, your daughter or granddaughter wanted to live and spend some time working for a human rights organization in territory that was occupied by a foreign power, and she wanted to get outside the wall, but she feared being arrested? How would you react? I just think this is an issue, really, of a really inhumane opinion that stems from tribalism and the failure to see outside the walls that we've erected around ourselves.
That's Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. We're taking your calls at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK here on your call. And I want to welcome Drew in San Francisco to the program. Welcome, Drew.
Hi. I'm a little bit perplexed in the sense that I agree very much with many of the observations of your guests today, and I think many Americans would if they got a chance to hear them. But few Americans get a chance to hear these sorts of perspectives, because as soon as such a perspective is brought up, the person bringing it up is called an anti-Semite. And I'm just wondering if the guest, having had a successful book, been in many places, spoken in places with other Jews as well as non-Jews, if he has any suggestions on how to deliver these sorts of messages without, or in a way that allows us to avoid being called anti-Semites, because it's clear that the state of Israel is undergirded by a very strong structural racism. And it's almost catastrophic, because in a way, it's almost like what they experience, they're, rotting onto other people. And it just, it's not, I believe most Americans in particular, because of the American experience they have, is something they would very much be against. And, you know, I would like to be able to talk about it, but I'm afraid of being called an anti-Semite. And
Drew,
I'd love to be able to engage my Jewish friends, but I'm afraid.
Drew, thanks for the call. Max, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, this is an American project, too. And Drew is right that there is a structure of racism that in the United States and U.S. taxpayers are funding. It's not just the $30 billion of aid that we've pledged over the next year. It's the total support of Congress in this campaign to suppress everyone who, especially people like Drew, I think, who identified as a non-Jew, who were really upset about what's happening there. But as Americans, it's really their job to speak out about it. And, it's affecting American policy, but it's also making life absolutely terrible for the people who are living in Israel-Palestine. And it's so funny that some of the harshest critics of and enforcers of this campaign of suppression don't live there and have no interest in moving there and only are, you know, interested in this fantasy land, Israel. I write about people in the book who take their Judaism very seriously. Yonatan Shapira is one of them. He's a grandson of Holocaust survivors. And I went out with Yonatan to a Palestinian village called Nabi Saleh, which is waging a campaign of unarmed resistance and protests against the loss of their land to a settlement. And we spent the night with a family that was expecting a raid. They were expecting their children to be taken at night to the Israeli military court and interrogated, and their fathers were also expecting to be arrested. And there was a patrol nearby. So we spent the night with them. I spent the night in order to document the raid. Yonatan, in order to basically get in the way of the soldiers and let them know that they couldn't commit any abuse and to bear witness. The raid never came. We wound up spending the next day on the porch of this family, the Tamimi family in Nabi Saleh, looking out at this land, looking out at the settlement, looking out at the watchtower that had been built to monitor all their movements. And Yonatan and the daughter, Ola, of the Tamimi family, started giving each other Hebrew and Arabic lessons. And this is the kind of future they want to enjoy, where they can actually live together as equals. The family brought us breakfast, and we said goodbye. And, you know, Yonatan talked about, you know, he sees it in terms of the Jewish experience in the past, of Jews being expelled in Europe, driven from their homes, of being confined to shtetls, facing genocide. And this is what really has motivated him and brought him into contact with Palestinians. And as we said goodbye, that was the last time I ever saw this family. The father died of kidney failure. He had spent years in Israeli prisons and had health problems. The son, Mustafa Tamimi, was shot in the face with a tear gas shell while he was protesting the Israeli army on their land, protesting without any weapons. And Ola, who witnessed her brother's killing, developed some serious problems. One that wasn't able to finish school and went off to Jordan. And the family was basically ripped apart, and their neighbors were detained. The entire village is basically practically under curfew. And so, you know, you're looking at this, you have to look at this not just from a religious perspective, but also that Americans are paying for this. Americans are paying for those tear gas shells. That tear gas shell was marked "Made in the USA" that killed Mustafa Tamimi. And so it's really the job of all Americans to study the facts on the ground that I'm presenting in this book, come to their conclusions and not fear speaking out about it if they're paying for it.
I want to get to a couple other folks who have called up. Catherine in Berkeley, welcome to your call.
Hi, thanks a lot. I want to totally agree with Mr. Blumenthal and also the caller, Drew. Anybody who gives any kind of counter-argument or tries to expand the argument or tries to include Palestinians, be it Israeli citizens or not, they get pilloried. And everything like this is absolutely suppressed. And if you're a non-Jewish person, then you're labeled anti-Semite, which is kind of funny because Arabs are Semites also. And if you're a Jewish person, then you're labeled a self-hating Jew. And it's just frightening at the level of suppression and censorship. And So, you know, I think that it would be very interesting to find out from Mr. Martin how many of your Jewish sponsors are threatening to pull support of KALW because of this program. Thank you so much.
First, we're on KALW and KUSP, so I am also the general manager of KALW here in San Francisco. So, KUSP listeners, I apologize for the insider discussion. Suffice it to say, we have these conversations across a broad range of subjects, and anything having to do with sponsorship and what we do on the air, those are independent from one another. Max, since we've got more folks on the line, I want to bring on our next listener, who is Ruben in San Francisco. Ruben, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
You're loud and clear. Go ahead.
Okay, so I just want to say a couple of quick things. Nice book that you wrote. Number one, the fact about one-third of the women in the Israeli army are sexually harassed is not true at all. That's a complete distortion. And actually, the American army has a 51 times higher rate than the Israeli army in terms of sexual harassment. Number two, 21 people since the last Gaza war have been killed, Palestinians, by Israelis, since the last Gaza war. So we're talking about 3 to 4 years. Let's say that number again, 21. In that time, 335,000 Arabs have been killed by other Arabs, whether it's Shiite or Sunni, Pakistan, Indonesia, and, of course, Syria. So I want to speak to that point about, you say, about Israeli violence, but you're talking about 335,000 men, women, and children being killed in the most horrible way from one Arab to another.
Do you have a question?
Can I finish? Yeah, you had the speaking. And third of all, when you say about going to Auschwitz, Auschwitz is not something that should be taken lightly by you. It is actually something very serious. And it's not to teach nationalism, but it's to teach the Jew and the Israeli army that one cannot rely on others to protect them. We can't rely on England.
Then Max, you'll have your opportunity to respond.
You have the radio ready. Let me finish, okay? And the fourth point is Hamas was given the Gaza Strip years ago. They were given it. Israelis had no power over it. The next day, Hamas destroyed all the businesses that were given to them, multi-million-dollar hot houses, tomato houses, and so on and so forth, destroyed. 2 days later, they declared jihad against Israel.
Ruben, we are short on time, so I want to give Max a chance.
Can I respond to the caller?
Please do.
The caller, what you just heard was a laundry list of Israeli state propaganda, which is 100% false. If you go to page 293 of my book, Goliath, I cite a Knesset Committee for the Advancement of the Status of Women in the Israeli Army in 2003 that found 1 out of 3 female soldiers had been sexually attacked during her service, and that at least 80% had suffered some form of sexual harassment. Over a quarter had been offered rewards in exchange for sex, and almost 70% said they had encountered an unwanted sexual proposition. So this kind of counteracts the idea that the army is really a democratizing force that promotes feminism. And I quote lots of feminists who've studied the Israeli army in that section. The caller, it's hard to keep up with the amount of propaganda, like that Israel doesn't control the Gaza Strip, even though if you go to the Gaza Strip and you attempt to go 300 meters close to the Israeli border, you can be shot. It's a buffer zone that's been declared basically a kill zone by the Israeli army. The whole Gaza Strip is under siege by Israel and Egypt and the coup regime in Egypt. So this is kind of absurd. It's basically a panopticon situation where Israel controls the Gaza Strip from the outside and from the skies. But the caller of evidence is a really fascinating phenomenon that I write about in my book called Hasbara, or the need to explain Israel's position in the world, because a state like this really requires aggressive public relations. So it's not what the previous caller said, that there's some kind of campaign to strip, you know, radio shows of funding for having this discussion. It's really that the shows can be bombarded with callers who've even been dispatched to provide this alternative, false, propagandistic narrative. And if you just go to the Amazon page of my book right now, this is something I've never experienced, but the book's been out since October 1st, and there are over 60 one-star reviews from unverified users who've almost reviewed nothing else on Amazon. There's one guy who reviewed, like, the DVD of Hot Tub Time Machine, and wrote this scathing review of my book, which he'd never read. So you have people being deliberately dispatched to the Amazon page of my book to drive down its rating and its ranking. I don't know from where, but then they and 0% of them have read the book. So, you know, read my book, check out my sourcing, and then come talk to me.
Well, Max, I have read the book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, and I really appreciate you writing it and going and doing the work of doing the reporting. There's so much to talk about in it. We're about a minute away from the end of this program. But I think one of the things that you really underline is the tension between being both a Jewish and a democratic state. So I'd ask you with 30 seconds, do you think both of those things can hold together?
Yeah, I mean, I talked at the outset of the program about how the two, there isn't a tension between a Jewish and democratic state. There's a fundamental contradiction, not because the state is Jewish, but when a state defines itself along ethnic lines and its population consists of immigrants, people who have come from the outside, and they need to displace the indigenous population, which leads to a complete corrosion of society and closure of the democratic space. And so what my book does is paint a picture of the state of Israel at, you know, about 65 years old, trying to hold on to this archaic and arcane system of ethnocracy in a world that's rapidly either democratizing or turning increasingly authoritarian.
Max Blumenthal,
examine the facts in the book and come to your own conclusions.
And you can also, if you are in the San Jose area, tomorrow night, tomorrow night, Max Blumenthal is going to be at the San Jose Peace and Justice Center. The book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Max, thanks so much for the book and for being here on Your Call.
Thanks for hosting this discussion.
You're welcome. I'm Matt Martin. Thanks for listening. Can a single city take on the big banks? On the next Your Call, we'll revisit Richmond, California's pathbreaking effort to use eminent domain to help residents with underwater mortgages keep their homes. What are the legal and economic challenges to the plan? How has the financial industry fought back? And are other cities with high foreclosure rates ready to follow suit? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.